originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to former riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit the website at www.pdjf.org. So my guest this evening is joining me in studio. He's in town for the Keeneland Spring Meet. And let me tell you, he's got a pretty incredible story riding his first race just a few years ago at the age of 29. He's already ridden at some of the most prestigious racetracks in the country during his young career. And I can't wait to hear his story. With 75 wins and over $1.4 million in earnings and counting, it's a pleasure to introduce jockey Carson Sullivan. Carson, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So great to have you here in studio. And let me ask you, how do you like Lexington, Kentucky?
Oh, I love Lexington.
Yeah.
It's beautiful and it, you know, it's just, it has so much tradition and it's a great place to be.
How about Keeneland and the crowds that come out for the races?
Oh, I mean, Keeneland's what racing's all about. Just when you're riding there, it feels natural. It feels like it kind of the whole reason you want to be a rider. Really, just because it's so beautiful and just so much culture and tradition.
Was that your first time coming to Keeneland here this meet?
No, I rode the last fall meet.
Okay. So you've already been.
So yeah, I have a handful of not many mounts. I mean, I think I have a handful of maybe 20 total mounts. So.
What do you think of the racetrack as far as, do you find that it's speed favoring or? What do you think of the
track? I think it's fair. I mean, the guys who take care of it are probably the best in the country. You know, and every track changes day to day depending on, you know, the weather and whatnot. But I think overall it's a pretty fair track. You know, some tracks, it's not like West Coast where it's often speed favoring or, you know, it's not deep like New York. I think it's pretty fair right in the middle.
See, and I ask you because you literally have
I've been all over.
Everywhere. Yeah, there's so many different racetracks. And so you know what...
Absolutely. They definitely have their different, I mean, it's, they definitely all have their own, you know, their own intricacies and style. And, but like I said, I think Kentucky in general has stayed pretty neutral.
Well, I would love to get to more of that later in the show, Carson, but I'd like to start out with, you are currently how old?
I'm 32.
You're 32 and you rode your first race at the age of 29.
Yes. I was an old bug boy.
You were an old bug boy.
Bug man.
So I want to find out how you got into the sport so late and why you decided to do so. And come to find out, you're from a family of racing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was completely in my blood and I was raised around it. I grew up right across the street from Santa Anita.
Wow.
And so my family going on my mother's side goes back generations, back to my great grandfather rode in the late 30s and 40s. And, just it went on. My grandfather rode, and then my mother didn't. My mother was a exercise rider and pony rider for years for some of the best stables in the country. And then my dad rode, and my stepdad was a very prominent rider too. And so it was coursing through my blood, and I was raised around it, but the racetrack can be tough. It can be a tough, hard life. And, they saw a way for me to go to some nice schools and, you know, have a nice education and maybe choose a different path. And so they kind of told me I was going to be too big. You got to do this. Go get your education. And I really was, at the age that I would have really started getting on horses, I wasn't even around it anymore. So it really wasn't an option for me until I started getting a bit older, and I'd come back to it and I'd go in the mornings and see it. And I couldn't stay away from it. So after a few years of doing some other things, I decided to come back to it.
It's in your blood, Carson.
I'm sure I couldn't keep away, honestly. And once it kind of gets in there, it's just who you are. It's
there to stay.
Absolutely.
It's definitely true. And as a young kid growing up with connections involved in racing, your family, you mentioned your dad and your stepdad. And did you go to the racetrack every day as a young boy? Did you get on horses as a kid?
Well, no, I didn't. You know, I got on ponies and stuff like that every kid around the track has. But I didn't, when I was the age that you would actually be, you know, to really start getting on horses and even galloping or anything like that, I was already away from the track. So really what happened was I was with my mother. My parents got divorced, and I was with my mother up until I was about 12 years old. And yeah, I was at the track all the time. I mean, I lived in the jocks room, you know, and especially being at Santa Anita in the early 90s was a great time to be around racing. I mean, every jockey in the room was a legend, you know, so it was that's the racing that I grew up with. And I remember, you know, my mom sneaking me on the backside, you know, because back then they were really strict about who came on the back. So I mean, I remember hiding under a blanket, even coming into Churchill, hiding under a blanket while she drove in to work horses in the morning. And she'd come out and give me hot chocolate during the break and stuff like that. And once I was up, I was, you know, wandering around the backside. And so, yeah, I was around it a lot. But didn't, you know, just at the age when I really would have started getting on horses. And my life would have been a totally different story if I would have started getting on horses, you know, at that age of 14, 15, 16. I would have already probably been riding 15 years now, you know. But it wasn't part of my story. And my mom took a job opportunity in Japan.
Wow.
And because of that, I went and stayed with my dad, who had then retired and started to take over a family business on his side, which was a lumber company. It was totally, totally separate. And so I decided to go live with them. They decided for me to go live with him and go to, they got me into a really nice school. And I did, I went to prep school and all that. And it was totally different from the racetrack.
Much different.
Yeah. So I did that. And those critical years where you would normally get on horses and really start developing your skills, I wasn't even on a horse. I mean, wow. I did not get on a thoroughbred until I was 26.
Wow. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. But hey, better late than never.
Oh, absolutely.
No. But really quickly, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You grew up in the jocks room in Santa Anita during the 90s. And as you mentioned, so many good riders were riding there at the time.
Oh, yes.
Name some names that maybe you got to know when you followed and maybe...
Well, I mean, Kenta Sorma was my hero. That was like when he was on top of the world. His wife, his old former wife, Sonia, used to babysit me. So he would come home, and he was in his early 20s. And, you know, I was in his back pocket. I just adored, you know, I just worshipped him. But to name, I mean, not just him, though. I mean, there was, you know, Eddie D was there. Mm-hmm. Chris McCarron was riding a lot then. You know, Lafitte Penkai was there. Just... I mean, the list goes on and on. Gary Stevens, I was good friends with TC, Gary Stevens' son. I played on the same little league team. Alex Solis was on top of the world then too. And it was just, I mean, the bench there was just so deep. So, like I said, that was the riding that I grew up with. That's what I saw as a kid, you know. So it was a really neat experience, but it also kind of, you know, is a different eye-opening experience when you go to ride some of the smaller tracks and some of the, you know, I wouldn't want to say bush tracks, but some of the, you know, off the beaten path tracks, it's a totally different experience. So, which is really great because it's all part of making you a good rider. So.
Exactly. I remember I used to gallop for Todd Pletcher,
mm-hmm.
galloping grade one winners. And then I start riding and I'm riding
$5,000. Yes, it's a much different story.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, so you were going to school, you're living with your dad, and while the idea of being a jockey was maybe in your head at a young age, you came away from that. You yes. weren't focused on that anymore, and you yeah. were going to school. And so you decided to go to college?
Yes, I am. I went to college. And I went to college because you're supposed to go to college, to be honest with you. That was what you do. Mm-hmm. So I went to college, and I ended up studying psychology.
Really?
And then really what happened for me in college was I fell in love with music. I mean, I'd always loved music, but I'd really fell in love with music. And I had a group of friends that we all played music together. And we formed a band, and we ended up playing a lot. And we started doing pretty well in college. So then we decided all to move together to New York. And that's how I ended up in New York. And actually, later on, it's how I ended up getting back into racing. But so we all moved together to New York, and I was a musician for about four or five years.
Really?
Yeah.
Psychology musician.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and I loved college. It's hard not to like college. It's a great atmosphere to be in. But I wasn't there. I really wasn't there as a student who wanted to learn, to be completely honest. It was great to be. It was great to go to college and everything like that, like I said. But I ended up spending more time there playing guitar, I think, than I did going to class, to be honest.
Nothing wrong with that.
No. It's a great growth period in your life, too. And I mean, I look at some young jocks that they almost lose that part of their life. And I think in a lot of, you know, you'll see some jocks almost find themselves getting into a little bit of trouble when they get a little bit older and stuff, because I don't feel like they got to live. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate. I kind of lived a few lifetimes before I even started riding.
And I completely agree with that statement. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was just thinking when I was doing research for this show and I saw the late age that you started riding, yeah. and I thought, you know, that's actually not a bad thing.
No, I mean, it can be considered. I mean, at first, a lot of people are like, oh, I don't know, you know, like my grandfather's like, oh, no one's gonna, you know, we gotta get you going now, then you're gonna be a 28-year-old bug boy. He's like, you know, he's like, no one's ever done a 28-year-old bug boy. And I was like, well, I mean, I stayed small enough, so that's not a problem. Mm-hmm. And at least I have the maturity there, because mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have had the maturity and discipline at 18, like a lot of these guys do. I admire some of the kids that come up that, you know, because it's hard work and you really have to stay focused. And I don't know, and being honest with myself, I don't know if I would have had that discipline.
Well, honestly, I rode when I was, started when I was 20, 21. And yeah, you don't have that maturity and, you know, money for one thing. As a 21-year-old kid, you're making a lot of money.
Exactly.
Guess what? You don't want to save it.
Oh, no,
you
exactly.
Have fun and go yeah. party and, you know, it's so again, I think it's actually a wonderful thing. You have that maturity. You can handle your business well. You're dedicated. You're focused. You already
exactly.
went through that stage.
I didn't
stage.
Miss out on anything.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So you're a musician.
Correct.
And you played the guitar. Were you a singer as well?
I attempted it. I would never call myself a singer. But yeah, we did some singing. We did a lot of like punk and hard rock music stuff. So okay. I could kind of get away with losing my voice after each show.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Now, so I met you at the PDJF event mm-hmm. Sunday night. And we were, you know, there was dancing and the auction. And it was a wonderful event for a wonderful cause. But they also had karaoke there. But I didn't hear you sing karaoke.
No, I wouldn't subject anyone to that. No, no, I'm not I wouldn't be good at karaoke. I always hesitate to jump on the stage and do that. I wasn't that kind of singer. If you want me to actually carry a good note, it was don't ask me. So.
So you were more heavy.
Yeah, I was more, well, I mean, it was just more expressive stuff. We were, you know, it was like I said, punk rock and stuff like that. So.
Now, can we YouTube the name of your band and find videos?
You know, I don't know if some of it might be up. But I was in a couple different bands, a lot of different bands at the end there. Mm-hmm. But you could probably YouTube some of, like, Alucius was one of the bands I was in. And then, but my college band that we did really well with, it was really, I hate to sound old, it was almost before people were uploading a lot of YouTube videos and stuff. I mean, we still had the MySpace going. It was,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was long yeah. before Facebook and all that stuff. So that kind of ages me, too. But there could be, I guess, some. But last time I checked, there wasn't much. And that was another thing. We were terrible at marketing. We just wanted to play
you
together.
You just wanted to have fun.
Really, to be honest. I mean, we just really enjoyed playing together. And then playing shows. We were a great live band because you could tell we were having so much fun.
Joggy Carson Sullivan is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Carson, you were having fun. You were living the dream. Musician, performing for live audiences. What made you question that career path for you, I suppose?
Well, simply put, you know, music was, I was making a little bit of money, but I wasn't making much. And I was bartending in Midtown Manhattan. And I did not want to be, for first of all, I did not want to be a guy who was like, yeah, I'm 40, I'm bartending, and I'm in a band, you know. I mean, I just didn't want to have that be that cliche, which is, you know, so prevalent in the music and arts business, you know, mm-hmm. industry. So that was first and foremost. But I mean, racing was always in my heart. I still always, you know, when I would go and visit, you know, my grandfather in Florida, or, you know, go to the races with my mom and stepdad, there was always a part of me that felt like, man, like, you know, like, I'm supposed to be doing this. Like, you know, like, what am I doing here? Like, we'd go in the paddock and, you know, we'd say hi, and they'd leg up a jock, and I'd be like, I, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't be doing this. And when I was bartending, I had a manager that started working there, and he was a huge racing fan. So we started putting on Naira Racing while I'm, you know, during the day. And if it was, you know, a day where we're usually really busy, but if it was a day where it was slow enough and I was behind the bar, I'd sit there and watch the races. And I was unhappy doing what I was doing. I mean, I loved playing music, but I didn't like bartending. And so when you're watching something like racing, when you know that it's not out of the realm of possibility for you and you're doing that, it was just, the decision didn't come much longer after that. I think one night I was out with some friends. Actually, I was out. One of my friends was going away to India, so we were out, and we were having a going away party. And I remember messaging my mom, because I asked her. I said, "Would you know my grandfather teach me if I went down there?" And she's, you know, out of nowhere, she was like, "Well, yeah, I guess he would, but you'd have to call him." And he breaks yearlings in Ocala, mm-hmm. so that was the, you know, best person I figured to go down there and start getting on horses for. And he's an old hard boot, so it was kind of. It was a good upbringing. So I called him and he said, yeah, come down. And I lived with him. So I went from bartending and playing music in New York and staying up real late every night and waking up real late every morning to a complete opposite lifestyle in Ocala, Florida. So it was a total 180.
Probably waking up right around the time you used to go to bed.
Exactly. Exactly. And going to sleep when I was like waking up from a nap, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was total 180. But it ended up being a lifestyle I love a lot more. I think you get more out of the day.
And so the psychology, the college, did you actually finish your degree, or you just...
I left one, which is still a sour subject with some of my family. No. I left one semester early.
No.
Yeah, which I still get teased about not going back. And I said, I can always finish it. Mm-hmm. But I just wasn't in love with psychology, to be honest with you. And I still might end up finishing a degree. Mm-hmm. But no, I left a little bit early, to be honest. Because, well, what happened was I was a slight bit younger than the rest of my friends. And they were all leaving, and it was in the band. And I was like, I want to go. I was like, I don't want to stay here. I want to go follow the band. So I left.
And then you left the band.
And then, that kind of just is a natural. We all kind of grow up. One of us got married. That changes things. So, I mean, the original core ended up breaking up earlier than that. We're still like best of friends. But that ended up breaking up, and I ended up playing in a bunch of different, you know, a bunch of different bands and a bunch of different, you know, projects.
But then you said goodbye to New York. You went to Ocala to learn from your grandfather. And now he rode races.
Absolutely.
Before.
Yeah, he rode his first race when he was 15.
Really?
Yeah.
Now tell me a little bit about his riding career.
Well, he rode, because my great grandfather rode and was very successful back in the 40s. And so he rode, and he started riding very young. I think he was galloping horses when he was 11 on the racetrack.
Wow.
But that's back in the 60s and stuff, where, you know, that 50s, you know, where that happened. And so he had a pretty good career, but he ended up getting a little bit big. So, you know, he got tired of battling with his weight, but he had a pretty successful career. I think he rode for, you know, 8 or 9 years, mm-hmm. Won his fair share of races. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up training horses for a long time, doing very well as a trainer, and then also was a farrier for years too. But now he breaks yearlings for a couple nice outfits down in Ocala.
And how about your dad's career?
Now my dad's career is a fun story too, because no one on his side of the family, you know, was involved in racing.
Really?
Didn't understand it. Didn't really, you know, just had not much of interest in it. So he got on his first horse because he wanted a sports car. And they told him the only way he could get it was if he made his own money. And he saw a sign that said gallop, you know, gallop horses for $4 a head, you know. So he's like, he walked into there and said, yeah, I know how to gallop horses. And he had no idea. They told him,
really?
They told him to go grab, you know, a bridle. And he came back with a girth. And they were like, all right, good. So they made him clean stalls and everything. And he ended up learning. And when my his parents were out of town. He was enrolled in college. When his parents were out of town, he sold his book money and ran to the track.
No way.
Yeah. And I think he started writing at Penn National, but he went to Maryland and did really well. And then he went to Atlantic City and was actually the leading rider at Atlantic City for a little while.
Really?
And John Service had his book.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, and he was a little bit. See, that my dad's an example, though. He was young and had a lot of fun. I think he blew the turn a few times. So.
Oh, that's my territory.
Yeah.
Maryland, Penn National, John Service. Have you ever been to Atlantic City yourself?
Not Atlantic City, no. But I rode a couple races at Penn National.
Okay,
I won my first race at Parks.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And John was my first job at the racetrack.
Okay.
So, galloping for John.
Family connections.
Yeah, fantastic.
I love it. Well, let's go back to talking about when you went to Ocala and you were learning from your grandfather and you had to get used to the different schedule and waking up early. And did you start out just from the ground up cleaning stalls?
Oh, yeah. No, he wasn't going to let me start any other way. I mean, obviously we were slightly pressed for time. He probably would have liked to have me for another year or so, mm-hmm. which would have been nice. But no, I started just going in early in the morning, helping out any way I could, cleaning stalls. I took care of the pony. And then in the afternoons when we were done with that, that's when I would go back and start getting on the horse, on a pony. I started on an old pony that I used to curse out every day, but he was so much smarter than me at the time and taught me a lot. But I had to get on bareback and ride bareback for a long time. Wasn't allowed any equipment.
That's good.
Yeah, no, it was.
That's good.
It was. And so I would have sore, raw legs for weeks until I learned how to handle it and everything. And so I slowly earned my saddle. And then I rode with a saddle with him for a little while. And then he started putting me on some of the babies, you know, some of the easier babies, mm-hmm. and which was great to learn on a young horse. So
I always say that it is so good for a young rider to learn with young horses. Because you really learn your seat, first of all,
than
trying to duck out from underneath you all the time. And you're both learning at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's a great
experience. You see how they develop and you see what makes them, you know, and you see them turn into race horses mm-hmm. because they're not when they first show up. And mm-hmm. what was great about it is that I didn't just, a lot of jocks now, I think they go to the schools and they don't learn anything about horsemanship. Mm-hmm. And I would be hard pressed to say that I know a lot about horsemanship. I think I know more than some because of my upbringing, mm-hmm. because I did, you had to be around it all. I mean, I had to see how you take care of them, how you, you know, from the bottom up. So, and it helped, I think that helps you become a better rider in the end and just a better horseman in general. So.
Well, and I think it's also so good to see all of the hard work that goes into actually getting a horse
absolutely
to the racetrack, because guess what? We get them for minute 30 seconds.
Absolutely.
And you appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, every inch counts for a person. I mean, you know, if you put your blood, sweat, and tears into a horse, there's a difference between third and fourth and fourth and fifth. It matters. And to a lot of jocks who started winning a lot of races, it means nothing to them. But mm-hmm. it actually means a whole lot to the people mm-hmm. that you're riding for. So every inch counts. And I think that really resonates with me every time I get on a horse.
Most definitely, yeah. Drives me nuts on this. Stayed up before the wire.
Yeah, you see some of the big shots, and I know they do so well, but you'll see them kind of pack it in a little early when they know they're not going to make $2,000 that race.
Most definitely. So you learned on the babies. You learned all that was involved with getting a horse to the races. What specifically did your grandfather teach you about riding races? Did he have a big part in that, or did he just maybe teach you from the beginning?
He did have a big part in it. I mean, I think he would have liked to have more. If I had more time, like I said, I would have been down there longer with him. We would probably have talked a little bit more strategy, but we would watch races together and we would discuss getting stuck into positions. We'd discuss waiting, you know, being patient. He always stressed a clock. That was really important. He said, you'll never be a rider if you don't have a good clock. You'll never be a good rider if you don't have a good clock. And he always expressed to me that there's a difference between jockey and race riders. He goes, there's tons of jockeys, but it's being a race rider and really riding, you know, your horse and riding a smart race is really what is going to separate you. And so, I mean, as far as, yeah, he did. He would have liked to have more, but he definitely was involved in all that. I mean, most of what I know is because of him and then obviously experience after that.
You mentioned having a good clock in your head, and that is so important. But for me, anyway, learning, that was maybe one of the more difficult things to really get in your head. And how did you learn to develop that?
Well, I used to practice with, what I sometimes still do, because as you know, as a rider, a clock, it's a living thing inside you. Sometimes you have it, sometimes it can leave you for a short period of time. And also when you switch to a different track, it can change things.
Yes.
When you're riding different level horses, it can change things. When you're riding a lot of cheap horses, and I like to ride all horses, I'm not saying anything about cheap horses, but your clock can change it. You have to understand that sometimes you feel like you're flying on a smaller, cheaper horse, and you get on a big horse that has a great stride and you feel like you're not moving. And you are flying.
Freezing 59
flat. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Which I have a funny story about that a little later. But I used to sit with a stopwatch, and I would start it, and I would in my head count it, and then I would stop it, and I'd try to be as close as I could constantly. So then what I would do is try to visualize. And I still, when I work horses, oftentimes I try to visualize when I leave the pole, like I'm hitting a stopwatch, and I can picture it in my mind. Mm-hmm. So I can get that, you know, and that helps. Mm-hmm. But as you know, too, sometimes there's things going on in a work that'll take your attention away from something like that.
Sure.
And that has to be like a nice, easy work going when you can do that. But that was a way to get me to understand, you know, 12s and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and work your way from there. But he was just, I mean, after every work or anything like that, he would say, well, how fast you go, you know, and I had to be pretty close. If I was off, then, you know, I heard it. So
that's very good.
Yeah.
That's very good. How about hitting a horse? I'm assuming you probably didn't do a lot of that with the babies at the farm.
Well, but fortunately he trained his own horses too.
Okay.
And so there was, I did get to work on to get to actual race horses.
Okay.
No, and you know, hitting a horse and all like that, there was things that he told me to do, and there was ways to it be done, but I couldn't really get good at it until I had to do it. And I mean, you always are working on it, but I was actually, riding for a year, and he'd still give me a call and be like, listen, you're hitting a horse like this, you need to be hitting a horse like that, you know, and that's constantly always working on it. And I'd be getting calls if things were slipping. I'd get a call from either him or any other member of my family with pointers. That's the one, it's a double-sided sword when you have a family rider, you know. It's they know when you're not doing well, mm-hmm. and they know mm-hmm. when you are doing well. So it's a good thing though.
Carson, let's take a quick
sure.
commercial break. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Jonk Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Javier Castellano had a solid week as he won 32% of his mounts, led North American earnings, and won the Charlestown Classic aboard Imperative. Castellano finished the week with 7 wins and 4 second-place finishes. Congratulations to Irad Ortiz Jr. for winning the spring meet riding title at Aqueduct. In addition to the riding title, Ortiz finished second in total earnings in North America. Ortiz finished the week in the money on an incredible 73% of his mounts from 9 wins, 7 seconds, and 8 third-place finishes. Joel Rosario had a great weekend as he won 4 races at Aqueduct on Saturday and 3 races at Keeneland on Friday. Rosario currently sits in first place in the Keeneland jockey standings and finished the week with 9 wins, 1 second, and 3 third-place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Fergal Lynch, was the only rider to win 3 stakes races last week. The Irishman won both local preps to the Black Eyed Susan and the Preakness as he guided home Lights of Medina in the Weber City Miss and Twisted Tom in the Frederico Tessio Stakes. Lynch finished the week with 5 wins, 2 seconds, and 1 third-place finish. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now at jockeytalk360.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny and provides the kind of entertaining read that is ideal for any racing fan. Visit jockeytalk360.com for more information. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 Weekly Update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit jockeytalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am your host, Christina McManigle, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Carson Sullivan. Carson, we were just talking before the break about the time you spent with your grandfather in Ocala, Florida, working with babies, also working with older horses. How long did you stay there for?
It was right around a year.
Right around a year.
Which is quick.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, it was compact. I mean, yeah. I live and breathe it every day. Which is what you have to do.
That's exactly right. And then, so, where did you go from there, and why did you decide a year?
Honestly, age was the biggest thing, yeah. and there's only so much you can learn. It was like a time to get to the races. Like, I knew I wasn't ready to ride races, but I had to get to the racetrack and start galloping race horses every day, working horses, stuff like that. So we made a call to John Service, and he was nice enough to give a green kid right off the farm a chance to gallop some of his horses.
And
that
was at Parks.
And then I was fortunate to go to Palmetto's with him.
Really?
Which was fantastic. Palmetto's is a great place to be.
Love Palmetto's.
Yeah.
Love Palmetto's. What year were you at Parks?
Let's see. I think I rode my first race, I think it was 2013. So it was probably 2012. And then I went down that winter and then came back up. So 2013. So between 2012 and 2013.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was at Parks, I guess it was 2011,
mm-hmm.
I think. So I just missed you.
Yeah, just missed me.
I just missed you. So working with John Service, what did you learn?
Oh, I learned, tons. I mean, I go into the racetrack and starting to get on actual racehorses and instead of babies. And, you know, I was always working out, thought I was strong. I mean, I had to learn how to finesse a horse because I was getting run off with. And he was so good to me. I was doing my best I could, but I learned a lot. I mean, you just learn what it's like to be at the racetrack, and it's just a totally different atmosphere. And he taught me a lot. I mean, I learned a lot. I got to sit on some good horses. I got to learn the difference. I watched him work and see what he did. He's a great trainer, good horseman, great guy. So I just really just learned what it was like to be, you know, not just, I galloped a lot for him, but when I started working a lot of horses is when I really started to learn a lot and getting sharp and starting to learn the difference between the way they work, you know, not just times, but the way they work and work in a company and the development of a horse in between races and stuff like that. I mean, just what you need to know, really.
You mentioned getting runoff with.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and they weren't even, it's fine. Not like all out runoff with like calling for the outrider, but just like trying to, when they would get, sometimes when they pick up the bid, I would, you know, at first you were just trying to manhandle them, mm-hmm. and they would show you that you're more, you know, I just had to learn to get a set of hands, mm-hmm. you know, and you can have a set of hands on babies, but it's a different type of set of hands. And, so I was, you just develop those, you know, and start learning or else you're not going to last very long. So
most definitely. And you said that about the babies. It's like, they almost need that,
hold their hand a little bit and teach them, but it's not, you know, they're not going to, generally, they're not going to get away from you.
Right.
But, I mean, some might if they're kind of like big colts that are already learning fast, but generally, they're not going to get away from you. But when you start getting to the racetrack and you get on horses and they're ready to really do something and they think they're, you know, you throw the bit up in their mouth, they're ready to really do something.
They're like, let's go.
Yeah. So and instead of you just being like, come here, I can handle you, it's like, no, no, no. So you have to learn a lot about that and just a lot about control and not panicking and just, you know, just a whole other education you have to get.
Most definitely. Yeah. Most definitely. Did you do any work with him in the barn, John Service in the barn? Or
yeah, well, when I went down to Palmetto's, he took a small string and he just had two of us down with him. So that's when I got to be a lot more hands-on and learn a lot more. And, you know, he's still the type of trainer that walks in early, feels other legs. You know, you don't see that as much anymore. But he's there, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning still. He comes through, checks each one of his horses. And I near that, you know, as long as the longer I was there, the more responsibility I got. So I got to know a little bit more about them, you know, just feeding them, you know, checking their legs, medications, all that stuff that, you know, an operation has to deal with. And then also I really like to sit with him after and see how he trained and what he decided they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And if they were ready to do this, or if mm-hmm. they needed to back up, or, you know, and I liked learning the individual aspects of each mm-hmm. horse and how they needed to be treated differently.
So you learned from John Service, both at Parks and at Palmetto's. Mm-hmm. Then you came back up to Parks.
Came back up to Parks and started, you know, that's when I decided to start riding. And, well, that's another rude, that's a big rude awakening when you first start riding.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yes. So that was, you know, and, you know, looking back, it would have been more convenient to be younger and have a few more years experience before. I always tell riders when they're like getting real antsy to start riding, I'm like, dude, don't rush into it. Mm-mm. Because you can never be too experienced before you go into it. You know, that's what I like a lot about European riders. When they, a lot of times they have already spent so much time, mm-hmm. you know, around horses and riding before they ride their races that they have a head start in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, but then the schools are good, I guess, for an aspect of just race riding, but not just the everyday aspect of getting on horses. So, but yeah, I started when I came back up and it was fantastic. I mean, I remember riding my first race and some of my family, I remember my grandfather even said, he goes, don't worry, it's just like the mornings, knowing it's not, but just telling me that so I wouldn't freak out. And my first race was in the slop, like just nasty sloppy day. Fortunately, I was on an older horse that he knew what he was doing. And we break out. And the track was sealed. And we break out, and it's, you know, the first, and, you know, as you know, races slow down for you the longer you do it. When you first start, everything seems to happen so quickly. And I remember breaking out of the gate and at first being like, wow, this is crazy. And then getting a big smile on my face, being like, this is so cool. And then a big mud slop hit me right in the face. And I went to move my goggles down and I moved all of them down.
No.
And I was like, oh no. And I fixed my goggles. And by the time I fixed my goggles, unfortunately, a horse in front of me went down.
Oh my God.
And it was like, you know, I had to, you know, swerve around him, come back around and then finish the race. And it was like, I got so much experience just in that one race. It was like, wow, holy cow. So it was a really neat rude awakening and experience for my first race. And then there on after, I mean, I think a lot of aspects of riding came to me quickly, but a lot of aspects of race riding came to me a little bit slower because of my age. Mm-hmm. I think because physically, you know, when you're 19, you fold up into a box, you learn muscle memory a lot earlier. When you're a little bit older, the athleticism part of it kind of slowly, it takes a little bit longer to really find yourself into the rhythm of it. And I think I was so mentally thinking about what's going on that sometimes I think I don't, you know, didn't look the way I wanted to look, where I want a bug boy to look and stuff like that. So it took, you know, aspects of it took a little longer than I would have liked, but I mean, that's your story. That's my story. That's just how it goes.
Now, did you spend your entire bug year at Parks?
No, I only rode for a little while at Parks. Actually, I only rode for about 2 months at Parks. And then I went down to Gulfstream, and my plan at Gulfstream, cause my year hadn't started yet. I only won, I think, two races. So my year hadn't started yet. And, I was like, let me go down there and get on some really good horses and ride some races with, you know, the best of the best. That way I can really learn. And then my year will start, you know, near the end of it. And then I can, you know, I'll have the seasoning I need and I can take my time. Even though I was older, my year hadn't started. So it was like, no big deal. Well, I started getting on horses for Nick Zito and everything. And I got lucky and I won like three races in a short period of time. And next thing you know, I'm started my year in the middle of Gulfstream in the wintertime. And it was like, oh no, this is so brutal. So, I mean, it was a great learning experience. And that's been really the story of my career in the early years, is that I've had the best seasoning. I've been, you know, riding with the best amongst all the best, but it's hard to be on the right one when there's 10 Hall of Famers in the room. Now, my first turf race was a 12-horse field going a mile on the turf at Gulfstream. And literally 10 of the 12 riders in the race were, you know, future Hall of Famers or like my heroes. Wow. Like Kent was on my right, Johnny V was on my left, and that was my first turf race. So, I mean, it was like trial by fire. I was like, wow, you know, you just, but it's great to ride at places like that, because if you don't get better, you stick out so badly that you just have to, you know, you have to get better. So it was really good for me.
Well, and it's definitely good to learn from the best versus surrounding yourself by just mediocre riders.
Absolutely. And so I mean, just the atmosphere in the room and sitting down and listening and just listening to them talk about things, you know, nonchalantly, but they the things they say amongst each other are things I hadn't even considered, you know, like, wow, I didn't even consider that, you know, and like stuff like that. It's just, it was such a good experience.
Did you have anyone in the room kind of take you on under their wing and show you the ropes?
Yeah, Kent would help me, you know, on occasion. And then, you know, I got a lot of advice from a lot of the guys, honestly, you know, just all of them would kind of would help you out. They're a classy bunch of, you know, riders and stuff. So I wouldn't say I had a true mentor. Like, it'd have been nice to have like a true just mentor that just completely takes you under the wing, kind of like Drayden had with Mike and stuff like that. That'd have been fantastic. But no, I didn't have that. But my stepdad was also there, Matt, and he was a great rider. And I was always, you know, he would always help me out and stuff like that too. So, and there's, you know, there's only so much you can do until you can hear from people, until you just have to be out there and doing it. So
just got to do it.
Yeah, you really do. You really
do. And plus, it sounds like you always had your family calling you. And
oh, I still do.
You still do. I love it.
I still talk shop after most of my races. You know, it's just how, you know.
That's awesome.
Fortunately, the longer you ride now, it's starting to get better, where it's like, you know, great job, instead of, hey, this and that and that and this. You know? So, but that's it. Hey, it's a blessing, really, because it just makes you better.
So you started your bug right in the middle of the Gulfstream Park Championship meet during the wintertime.
Correct.
Which had to be very difficult.
Very.
And did you stick through it? Did you stay there for the rest of that meet?
I stayed for the rest of the meet. Probably should have left earlier, but I stayed for the rest of the meet, and I got a call to go out to California. So I went out to California and I rode Del Mar just to make things easier for me. Just to make things easier for me, I decided to go to Del Mar. And I think I ended up with a couple wins at Del Mar, which was really neat. I had the biggest payoff horse. I had a horse that paid like $108 on the turf. So that was really great. And it was the same situation. I just got to keep furthering being seasoned amongst the best, you know. But as you know, as a rider, you get judged by stats a lot. So that was never helping me. And then after that, I went up to Golden Gate, and that's kind of where I started really starting to sit and get in a groove and win, you know, start winning on a regular basis.
And why did you decide to go to California?
I had some friends, actually, you know, Anthony Stevens. He had a friend who asked him about bugs, and Anthony had watched me ride and said that I wasn't getting the opportunities I needed. Mm-hmm. And so he made some calls, and I had an agent call me out there, and it was actually Kent's agent. And I ended up going out there and working with them for a while. So it was a decision I had to make quickly, but I was from there. So I was kind of excited to go. And you know, whenever you leave a track, it's always like a new beginning. You always get to, you know, and so I was excited. So it wasn't really a hard decision for me to make, but it was a big decision because, I mean, I literally moved across the country, you know, like that, you know, so. And it all worked out, though, because, I mean, even though Southern California was tough, it ended up leading me up to Northern California, where I got to, you know, kind of get in a groove, like I said, and where you ride five or six a day and you get to win and you start to, you know, just feel better. You get more confidence. Cause I think a rider's biggest weapon is his or her confidence. And, you know, you need to get that. You can ride and get all the season you want, but if you don't really feel confident out there, you're not going to really perform well, make the right decisions, you know, the horse feels it, I think. So,
oh, they feel it.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So when you're, that's why I was deadly too. If I won early in the day, I was like, oh, I'm going to win another one, because it's just like, you just feel like you're going to make the right decisions. And
well, that's why you oftentimes see jocks, you know, they have hat tricks, and
yes.
Yeah. It's because you're just on top of the world.
You really
win one or even two, even better, then you keep your confidence continues to grow.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, you can see a lot of riders at track. Sometimes they're leading rider and you're like, oh, this guy isn't that great as leading rider. But because they're winning every day, their confidence is so high. That's why they, you know, I think that's why they could continue on. Besides obviously riding the best horses all the time. It is a big confidence thing. Confidence is a huge, huge weapon to have. And it's something you have to always dance with because it's easy to lose, you know, so.
You can't focus on that race you really think you should have won.
No. And that's a tough thing. You know, you have to deal with, I think, one of the things I found hard to deal with at first. Now I'm learning, you know, much better. But I would hold my defeats with me longer than I would let my wins make me feel good. You know, I was like, yeah, I'm supposed to win. But when you lose a race, you feel like, oh, man, it just, mm-hmm. you know, if you got taken down or something like that, it would just eat you up.
God, yes.
Yeah, and you really have to learn to just brush that off. And that helps when you're riding a bunch a day. You know, when you're riding only a couple every now and then, it really, that makes it a lot more difficult because you feel like you're getting less opportunity. You know, you have to make these count. But when you're riding, you jump on a horse the very next race and it's like, oh, you know, get to redeem yourself.
Turn the page.
Exactly.
Most definitely. And so that had to be cool going to California and working so closely with Kent, who you knew for so long, and you were working with his agent.
Yeah.
You said, so you guys were basically kind of working together. That had to be a cool experience.
Yeah. I mean, he was taking care of his business. I was taking care of mine, but yeah, anytime you can learn how they're doing, you know, and he had a really good meet that meet too. So it was neat to see, you know, how they go about winning every day and riding every day and, you know, working horses and stuff like that. So yeah, it was absolutely, it's great learning. Great. And like sitting down in the room and hearing him and Mike speak about races. I mean, for a young rider, that's priceless. And if you just sit and listen and just take what they're saying in amongst themselves, and it can seem so small, like, you know, but it's things you didn't necessarily consider, and things you learn about the nuances of a race that, you know, that now moving forward, you learn, and it just makes you so much better.
Jockey Carson Sullivan is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So Carson, you were doing very well at Golden Gate.
Can't complain. Yeah.
And how long did you stay there for?
Not long enough, probably. To be honest, I stayed a little bit less than a year, and I let some people talk to me and get in my ear about leaving. And California is having a little bit of a rough time with the lack of horses. And I knew my career was still in the early stages, and I wanted to go somewhere where I knew it wasn't going anywhere. And I'd always dreamed of riding in New York. And I had a couple of people be like, well, we can set you up at Saratoga. And I was like, you know, they're like, it's going to be a tough meet. You probably won't do great there, but you can move on to Aqueduct in the wintertime. And, you could probably start doing well there. And I was like, oh, you know, that sounded like music to my ears. So I went to Saratoga, and it was fantastic. It's one of the best riding experiences I've had riding there, because it is great and is the best of the best. But it's, like I said, as before, I just made it so difficult not having a stable or the right, you know, connections. You're not on the right one, you know, very often. So I rode that summer there, and I was about to go to Aqueduct, and I had everything lined up. I had just gotten an apartment, and my fiance, Emily, was flying in from California, like, to move. She was moving. So I was up at the driving to the airport to pick her up, and we were going to move into our apartment. I was going to ride at Aqueduct. And on the way there, I had a call from the guy who was going to be my agent, and I won't mention his name. But we decided not to work together during that drive to the airport, which was like life crushing for me at the time, because I thought I had everything lined up, and I was like, well, there's no way I'm gonna stick here in New York without an agent, it's tough enough, but without a connection or anything like that. So she got off the plane, and I looked at her. I go, how about Kentucky?
Oh my God!
And that's how we didn't get here right away, but that's how I ended up coming to Kentucky.
Wow. So that had to be kind of a surprise for her to walk.
Yeah, she was a trooper. She handled it really well. I mean, she was like, okay, you know, and in the end, I think it's better. I think we're a lot happier than we would have been living in like Queens or something like that. We had a small one bedroom apartment that cost us a fortune. And I mean, I had already lived in New York, so I knew that I could, you know, be used to it, but also my lifestyle was a lot different. So being on the racetrack and living in New York is probably a totally different experience. And I rode a few races at Belmont and stuff just before I left. But, no, and then we packed up and moved to Kentucky.
Wow. That's your whole story just so well explains the gypsy lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely.
Yours may be more extreme than others.
Yeah.
But that just goes to show you, you had to pack up your bags and, hey, let's go to Kentucky.
Yeah, yeah. And I was absolutely, you know, I was never had a problem with the gypsy lifestyle. And now that I'm here, though, I will say I'm done as far as just like, you know, I'll go somewhere. But I'm definitely putting my roots in Kentucky. It's where I want to stay, raise a family. It's where I want to live.
That's awesome. So. That's awesome. Well, we are glad to have you guys here in Kentucky.
Thank you very much.
And so, again, going back to our previous conversation, you've been riding the spring meet here at Keeneland, and you live here in Lexington?
Yeah, we just got a place in Shelbyville. So it's right between, you know, Louisville and Lexington, which is a good spot, you know, because there's so many things are so spread out here. It's not like you're just at one track the whole time. There's so many farms you go to, training centers, you know, so it's a good location to ride at any of the tracks because there's, you know, you have Indiana, you have Churchill, you have Belterra, and you're trying to really, until your feet are completely cemented in the colony, you're riding all of them. So, yeah, we have a place there, and that's where we're going to stay.
And so you will ride the Churchill meet and maybe go to Ellis Park?
Yeah, I'll ride Churchill. I'll probably be riding a lot up at Belterra on horses that I think I want to go up there and ride. I actually went up there 11 times last year and won 5 times. So
wow. So
I couldn't complain about that.
Yeah.
If I can keep that kind of thing going, I'll do that.
Makes it worth the drive?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and it you know, just building relationships, you know how it works. You just have to build relationships. So if a trainer that you want to get in with that says, hey, you know, you can't ride this one here, but if you want to go there, then, you know, you get in your car and do it. So
that's exactly right.
Yep. So,
and you're all, who's your agent here in Kentucky?
Right now I have Steve Capps.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I just started with him and, he's working hard. So see how things are going.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's, and they have a tough job. Agents.
Oh no, I wouldn't want, I would be terrible at it, to be completely honest with you. And I haven't had the best luck with a lot of agents, and, I don't blame any of them for it. It's just, that's how it goes. But I would be bad. Like, I wouldn't be able to retire and be one of the ex-jocks that becomes an agent. Mm-hmm. I'd be terrible at it because this is not, you know, I just want to get on their backs and ride. And I'm good at socializing, but I'm not necessarily good at, you know, walking around as a salesman, which, you know, you kind of have to be sometimes.
No, most definitely.
Yeah,
so. You really do. It is a tough job.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I remember my own career, anything that would, you know, a trainer might come up to you and, oh, why didn't you have a double call in a race? And why didn't you ride my horse?
Oh, that's
the
best part
about
the agent. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, like what happened with the agent? I'm like, oh, I really wanted to, you know.
Exactly. Blame the agent.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way to
yeah,
do
they
it.
They are the scapegoat mm-hmm. a lot of it. But hey, they get to stay safe and get a chunk of our money. So can't feel too sorry for
them. No, I don't. I definitely don't. Yeah. So now you're here in Kentucky to stay. And what are career goals that you have for yourself now?
Well, I mean, it's funny how things slowly change, but I mean, you want to be on top. I mean, if you're not riding at some point and want to be on top, and it you know how difficult that can be, and that very well may never ever happen to where you are a leading rider in the world or whatever, but that's what you're always going to eventually strive for. But I would first and foremost just, you know, I want to provide for my family. I want to have, you know, I want to have a, you know, them to grow up comfortably. But I would like to, you know, if 5 years from now, I'd like to see myself completely just riding Kentucky only. I'd like to see myself competitive in the standings time year after year. And then the whole reason you get involved is the big races, you know, not just the Derby, but any of the graded stake races, the grade 1 races. And you want to ride, I want to ride as many of those as I can and win as many of those as I can. And, you know, you want to ride the best horses, and that's what it's all about. I mean, really, it's all about the horses. And, that's when you're on good horses, it just makes you so happy. You understand what it's all about. You really love even more what you do when you get to be on the best horses. And so my goal is to just position myself and work hard and move my way up and get the opportunities. I mean, we're only as good as the opportunities we get, and that's what you work hard for. It's what you get up in the morning for. And I just want to get those opportunities and make the most of them.
Can't believe this hour is flying.
Yeah,
cars.
Yeah,
we just have a couple minutes left, but describe to us your riding style. Now, obviously, jockeys try to be on the best horse and versatile and front. You want to send the horse speed. You want to come from behind no matter what. I just want to win.
Absolutely.
But I will say during my own career, I always loved those deep closers, and I love the strategy involved with riding a smart race or placing yourself in the correct spot. What would you say your riding style is and what you're really good at?
I would say I'm best at speed horses. although my favorite to ride is a deep closer.
Yeah.
It's so neat to feel a horse kick into a gear and start passing horses. It is a blast. It's fun being in the pack, knowing you're loaded, and then hitting a hole. I mean, that is what we ride for. It's fantastic. But if you look at my stats and the career and everything, I'm very good at milking a lead. I'm very good at walking, you know, walking the dog. I'm very good at, I'm over, if I get to the lead, I'm over 35% in wins.
Wow.
So I'm good at, if I have a lead, I'm good at getting a horse to relax on the lead, you know, and that's can be a deadly weapon.
You have that clock in your head.
Yeah, no, it does help. It absolutely. Does. Yeah. I mean, it is. I'm so I would say it's a strength of mine, but I don't ever want to be pegged as a speed rider. I want you, obviously, like you said, you want to be known as versatile. If I had to say I had a strength, though, I am going to lead. If you don't want me on the lead, if you're trying to beat me, if I have horse and I'm on the lead, I'm going to be tough to beat.
I love it. You've ridden at so many great racetracks, Carson. Where's your favorite place to ride? I know you're in Kentucky now, but which is your favorite racetrack?
My two favorite racetracks, and I have to split it to not to cop out, but is Keeneland for sure, mm-hmm. and Saratoga.
Ah, those are my two favorites.
Yeah, I mean Saratoga, just because it is literally the oldest sporting place in the country. It has the Travers, and the Travers is the one race I want to win more than any other race. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know everyone wants the Derby, and of course, and obviously you want the Pegasus now because of the money, but really when it comes to prestige, I'd love to win the Travers because it's been around for so long. But Saratoga is just, you know, great. But then Keeneland, both these tracks, when you're on a horse, it feels natural. You feel like you're supposed to be on a horse. When you're at racetracks where you look out and there's a freeway in the background, you know, it just doesn't feel like quite as natural. But when you're in the post parade at Keeneland, you feel like you're supposed to be on horse's back. You feel like it could be 100 years ago. You know, it could be any time period. It could be anything. It's just about you and the horse and racing. And I think it's the two. I think both places do everything right as far as the horse, the way that, you know, I'm sure a horseman could say, you know, there's always trainers complaining about something, but you could debate that. I think they do things really well there at both places. And as far as spectators and fans, you know, those short meets where everything's packed in, you know, it's just, it's that much more magical. And it has a lot of energy coming down the lane. It's really neat.
The atmosphere at both of those racetracks, as I just said, those are also my two favorite racetracks. And I can't decide between the two because they are both awesome because of their own qualities, mm-hmm. and the atmosphere at both racetracks, people get so excited.
Yeah.
And that's what I wish more racetracks had, such great turnouts, because it's just, those are both great, great places to be really quickly. Carson, do you have anything coming up for the rest of the Keeneland meet?
Absolutely. I have one on Friday and I have a couple on, one on Thursday and a couple on Friday. So I think I'll get lucky this last week. So,
I love it. Carson, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
this
my
evening.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Don't forget, join me and the Big A, Anthony Stabile, tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. We will bring you 3 hours of live racing coverage right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.